Welcome to Crazy Shit in Real Estate, a weekly podcast where I walk you through some of the wildest, most unbelievable stories you'll hear from the world of real estate. If you like real estate and you love crazy, this is a podcast for you.
And welcome back to the podcast. I'm Lee Brown, and you're listening to Crazy Shit in Real Estate. And today, you are going to be super glad that you tuned in because it's the first time that the podcast has featured a sitting president or a sitting immediate past president, I guess. Today, you're going to get to meet President Bill Brown from Oakland, California. He is the when did the dates change, Bill? The immediate past president, I guess, of the National Association?
Well, it's the day after the board of directors meeting in November.
So is this your first interview without a script from the speech writers?
Yeah, I don't use scripts in interviews really, but it's my first post-presidential script or interview, I should say. And I'm glad it's with you.
Well, I'm very honored to have you on the show. If you're a listener and you don't know anything about President Bill Brown, I want to let him tell us a little bit about who you are, how you came into real estate, any background pieces you want to give people. And we're going to tell them the big part of your story in a second if they don't know. But I wanted to know who you are. You gave us a great video when you became president last year to introduce yourself to the realtor leadership who didn't already know who you were. So what if there's a regular person listening who's never met you? What do they need to know about you besides the fact that your wife's pretty awesome?
Well, she's very awesome. I'm a second generation realtor. My father started the business back in the 60s, I think. And, you know, he first sold insurance. And then back then they used to have what they called a debit. And that was an area where they would literally walk door to door and try to sell people life insurance. And, he finally figured out that, life insurance versus selling their homes, I can make more money. So, he used his debit as his, first farming area. And, things went well for him. And it was very inspirational, both my brother and myself, because, after sophomore, junior year in high school, I knew what I wanted to do. So, it was a pretty easy entrance into the business, because I saw my father doing it.
So that's interesting because a lot of kids of realtors spend their lives swearing they'll never do real estate, but then you wind up in it anyway because it does get in your blood. So what about real estate, besides the fact that you saw your dad become highly successful and it was attractive to you? Was there some angle of it that you felt like belonged to you?
I like the idea of working for myself. And, I'm in the apartment business and, being an ex-athlete, I love the competition because, they're always, by the way, I live in Alamo, California now. We moved about almost 2 years ago, but when I was in Oakland, when I was constantly doing brokerage, you're competing with, probably 10 other people, for listings, for, buyers. I love the competition. And, I discovered that, personally, I was better with numbers than I was with, the residential side of things with open houses and showing buyers properties. And, I just kind of stuck with what I knew. And that was, the numbers game because, it's not that hard to sell, apartments or commercial or retail properties, if you have a good grasp of the numbers. So, that was kind of my strong suit. And that's where I went.
Well, that's a pretty big if, though, because you and I both know that of our almost 1.3 million Realtor members, math is not a strong suit for most realtors. That's not their wheelhouse.
Well, yeah, but you know what? It's I think anyone can learn how to do commercial or apartment brokerage, but you have to devote yourself to it. In most cases, about 15, 20 years ago, you used to hear a broker say, I do a little bit of everything. I think that's impossible. Now, you have to be a specialist. Residentially, you should be a specialist in your area. Apartment-wise, you should be a specialist in your area. But you have to concentrate on the product type that you like the best.
But you also have to have an inordinate amount of patience to do the commercial and apartment side of the business. So are you a patient person by nature, or is that something your dad taught you or that you learned along the way?
I'm one of the most impatient people you've ever met. But as you said, as we go on with the story, my patience has gotten a whole lot better in the last 3 or 4 months. But I am pretty impatient. And, you know, it's funny. I'll never forget a story that I was told a little while ago. Well, it was over 10 years ago by a buddy of mine who was a broker in charge of a group down in the peninsula. He had an agent walk in his office and said, "Yeah, I'd like a job here. First job, first time selling apartments." And the new agent just graduated from Stanford, and you know, smart guy. And you know, my friend counseled him, and he said, "Look, it's going to take you in this business. It could take you 6 to 9 months to make a deal. So just be conservative with your money." And he was in the office, I think it was his 8th or 9th day, picked up a phone, got a listing, and made, I think it was $125,000, when the deal closed. And, you know, my friends tell me, "Look, this is very unusual. Save your money." This guy he literally just kind of went with his own instinct, you know, bought the new BMW, new apartment in San Francisco. He rented a new apartment in San Francisco and didn't do another deal for a year and a half. So, you just have to be smart, especially when you're starting out.
So I'm interested in that, because one of your primary goals in your year of being the president of our trade association was to get realtors to think better about their own financial well-being and to make sure that they're considering purchasing a primary residence for themselves and that they consider buying investment properties and planning for retirement. So was this guy's story part of the background that pushed you towards wanting realtors to think about that more specifically?
No, it wasn't, because you're referring to our realtor retirement pack, and that really isn't what made me create that pack. But I just see realtors who are my age who, you know, they've been making good money throughout, say, a 20 or 30 year career. And, you know, they get to 55 or over, and they have nothing. They have nothing to live off of. I mean, the stories are endless about, 55, 60 year old realtors going in and, you know, trying to borrow money from the broker or from other realtor friends. And, you know, I think it's very sad. So, I mean, my thing is, I want realtors to start thinking about retirement early. You know, not when you're 50, but, you know, when you first start. I have a very good friend of mine from Sacramento, Tracy Sizon, who is, I'll never forget, she put away something like, and I might be off on this, but she put away something like, it's either 10 or 20% of every commission, she put it away. And, since she's been working, you know, Tracy's been fine. I mean, she's done real well. And, you know, I want more realtors to start thinking like that. You know, I couldn't talk about this subject without giving kudos to Sharon Millett, who chaired the PAC. I mean, this is really going to be something that our members are going to be able to take advantage of. We just signed a partnership with Merrill Lynch, /BofA. And, they're going to set up some very, very good programs for us.
Well, it's going to be a huge part of your legacy that you give people something to have as a basis for planning. So this guy who made his big money right out of the gates by accident, he could have budgeted more specifically and done better over time, probably, if he'd had some of the tools that are going to be available thanks to your initiative in that area, which I think is awesome. But maybe he planted the seed. He didn't even know it.
When I hear some of the stats, all of our members are not making a living. I talked to a buddy of mine who runs an MLS. They have about 17,000 members, and half of his members have not done a deal in a year, and 30% haven't even turned the MLS on. So it's a tough business. It's getting more and more competitive. You know, when the market starts going up, everybody thinks that, I'll just get into real estate. And they almost think it's easy. They have no idea, how hard the business is. And they really don't have the commitment. So, it's time for young people like you to, and I know you've you've invested well, you know, just from how we've talked together, you know, in the past. But it's time for young people to start thinking 10, 20 years out where they want to be. And I hope that program will help them.
So let's look at that. If we're thinking 10, 20 years out, we know that not all realtors are created equal because there's no rhyme or reason in some markets to why some realtors are highly successful and others can't put food on the table. Yet real estate on the whole is perceived as being this giant bucket of money that the legislators on the municipal, state, and federal level can dip into at any time. So during your presidential year, you've had one of the most interesting political times we've seen in the United States with President Trump, and now with this gigantic, wild tax reform package that's just come through the House, and now we're waiting on the Senate to look at their plan. What are your thoughts from the 30,000 foot view of being the head of this giant trade association coming from one of the most expensive states and fiscally irresponsible states in California? What are your thoughts on this whole picture that we're seeing play out, and how is it going to affect real estate in the next 10 to 20 years, do you think, with your magic crystal ball that you have?
Well, my magic crystal ball. But, you know, we actually have some context here because look what happened. What was it, 31 years ago when they passed 1986 tax reform? I mean, mm-hmm. property values went down. Also, I'm pretty sure interest rates were on the rise. I mean, it's almost a very similar situation. And I'm actually, you know, I like the action. I like the political legislative stuff. And I'm glad I was president when this started because I think we got aggressive. I mean, but let me tell you how they think back in Washington, D.C. I had a meeting, Del Stanton and I had a meeting in Washington, D.C. with, Chairman Brady, you know, the chair of Ways and Means. And I just brought that. I brought up the point to him. I said, "Mr. Chairman, don't you remember what happened to real estate after 1986 tax reform?" His response: "Oh yeah, I know property values went down, but that's just going to last 3 or 4 years. We're looking 10 years out." I mean, my jaw dropped. But you know, there's this big argument about. I mean, well, let me step back. What they want to do is they want 80 to 90% of Americans to be able to fill out their own tax return, and to put that tax return would be the size of a postcard almost. It's a little bigger, but I mean, I think you get the point. But I mean, the effects on a state like California, if you eliminate the ability to write off state and local taxes, if you eliminate mortgage interest deduction, I mean, I've seen estimates to say, you know, our home values would decrease 21 to 24%. And, you know, you can't get, it's very tough to find a home, at least where I live. And, you know, I say where I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, I mean, $1 million buys you nothing. So, you know, this $500,000 deduction that they're talking about is going to be useless here, but it's a real big deal not to be able to write off your taxes in the state, as you said, you know, is tax crazy. I mean, they've just gone nuts. I saw a survey, Lee, about 2 weeks ago, and it was a Bay Area home buyers, and 35% of those home buyers said that if, you know, these provisions were eliminated from the tax code, it would give them pause and make them think about buying a home. So, I mean, it's the ramifications from this will be unbelievable in your high, especially in your high cost states. And, you know, it's NAR. I mean, one of our just, you know, real core values is to protect private property rights. And it doesn't get any purer than this. This for us is a fall on your sword issue. And by the way, back in 1986, when they lowered the mortgage interest deduction from unlimited to $1 million, they said, we'll never lower this again. Granted, it was 31 mm-hmm. years ago, and, you know, no one wrote down a contract or shook hands, but, you know, we've already given it the office. And, you know, I think the message needs to be loud and clear that if you are a congressman or a senator who we have supported, when I say we, NAR, has supported, if you vote for this bill, we are going to be very active on the other side of your election come 2018. I mean, California has, we have nine Republican congressmen, and I believe only three voted against the bill. I mean, it's insane to think that those other six congressmen would not represent their constituents, but they are, you know, kowtowing to the Republican leadership. It's unbelievable.
And it's crazy to me because I come from a reasonable coal state in North Carolina, but there's provisions in there that they're not good in my area either. And I've had a lot of conversations with realtors in less expensive markets than California or New York, and they say, but the bill, you know, means we have a wash. So you have experience with real estate in states besides California. So what provisions bother you about tax reform that aren't related to the two talking points that we keep hearing over and over, which would be property taxes and mortgage interest deduction? Because like for me, that relocation bit is killing me because the house bill says you're going to be dinged for capital gains if you're in a house less than 5 out of the last 8 years, which means we're going to destroy our military families who purchase properties. They'll now have a ding on any equity they manage to make, and they often don't have much equity in the first place, so they'll lose a piece of the action. And then our relocation folks, who a company picks you up and moves you from Seattle to Minneapolis, now they're going to get hit with capital gains. I think that's a detriment to the less expensive markets. But I'm curious about your viewpoint as somebody who, outside of California, why should people be concerned about tax reform?
Well, they should be concerned about it because it takes away the incentive to buy a home. Now, the other side's going to say, yeah, but, you know, the itemized deduction has doubled. So, you know, you could just take that. But I mean, we want specific mortgage interest deductibility. So, a buyer, look, I mean, a lot of times that write-off is the last thing that really pushes a buyer, over the threshold to make the purchase. Because as I said, I mean, I think, property values are going up everywhere, you know, different rates, but they're going up everywhere. And, you know, the ability to, to have a write-off, is very important. And you know what? It's, I mean, think about, and once again, I'll use my state as an example, but, if, a couple gets married and then they go, they save, 3, 4, 5 years, they work to save, $200,000 to buy a $1 million home. And, if tax reform hits, and if home values do go down, they've just lost their down payment and, the effort they put in the last 3 or 4 years of saving. And, it's psychologically, it's tough. I mean, I was talking to a guy who had, he was a manager of a car wash. I was getting my car wash. Manager of a car wash. This place is in a city near me called Lafayette. And it's so busy. It's busy all day long. I think that they have two or three managers, and they make $85,000 a year. And this was a couple of years ago, but I asked him, I said, man, you don't have any write-offs. Why don't you buy a house? Without missing a beat, his first reaction was, I'm not going to lose my money like a lot of my friends did, in the downturn. So, I mean, I think that, psychologically, this would just be another, it's not a nail in the coffin, but it's a deterrent, would be a deterrent for some to really, go out and make the purchase.
And that's a good point, because the timing is still fresh for a lot of people. And I feel that the media and the elected officials, they've all moved on from that recession. But those of us that deal with buyers and sellers of real estate know that there's honestly some kind of a PTSD thing going on for people who came through 2007 to 2013, because some areas of the country, property values are just now getting back up to pre-recessionary levels, less making actual moves in equity. And so it does add to the fear factor. So that's a good viewpoint on that. I want to switch angles on you here. You're a successful businessman. You've got an amazing wife. You've got a great life in California. Why did you land in volunteer leadership in this association, which is hours and hours of time spent and energy invested for free, because it's volunteer leadership? And what drew you into that? Why did you stay with it? And tell us about that, little bit about that journey. Why would a regular realtor want to get involved where you got involved?
Well, for me, it goes back to 1982. I was a apartment broker I was doing okay. And, I bought a couple of small buildings, myself, actually with my brother and my father. And all of a sudden this thing called rent control, came on the horizon. And then, you know, it was put in front of our city council, and the city council voted it down. But, the tenants, had a, they got an initiative on the ballot, to institute rent control in Oakland, which is at the time where we were, where I lived, where we were investing. So, I saw this as I said, wow, if this passes, it's going to have a direct influence on my ability to make a living. So, I went down to the board. We used to call the board of realtors back then, but, my local association, and, volunteered to help against rent control. And I wound up being the, chair of, the ballot measure. Actually, they tried it twice. It was Measure E and then Measure EE. And I wound up being, chair of, the second campaign, Measure EE. We were fighting the rent control initiative. So, that a light bulb went on. I said, man, it's the, realtors really do help their members, make money, stay in business and so forth, because, all of these events were organized by the board. And, so that kind of got me into it. And, I was, I got on some committees at the local association. Then I became president in 84, and, I absolutely loved it. And, that kind of prompted my, interest, to get a little more involved with our state association, California Association of Realtors. And, I did it basically started off at the committee level. And, I've been involved for a long time, but, I say that because I've chaired pretty much every public policy and PAC committee at CAR, while I was involved there. And in 2008, I had the, privilege of being president of my state association. Those institutions really have, an impact on their members' business, but the members need to participate with their time and with their money to help make, whatever initiative, they're working on successful. So that's really kind of how I got started. And, it was, coming out of college, I knew I wouldn't have any job interviews. I was pretty sure my dad would take me. In fact, I mean, he wanted his kids to go in the business if possible. I mean, I say that, but, I think you mentioned it earlier. I have some friends who have just thriving residential businesses, two or three kids, and, a lot of them aren't interested. The kids aren't interested. I mean, they're graduating from college. They're more interested in technology and, type businesses. And, they're really, they're not focused on it yet, but, I was, and I'm really glad I was, because, it's been a fantastic ride.
So you've been involved for a long time. So now that I know it's 84, that's a good music year. That was when Duran Duran's
Union Reflex
came out. That's how I know 84. That was a good album.
The Reflex.
The Reflex. See, the Duran Duran is my band because I had their poster on my wall while you were volunteering at the board. So thinking about all your years in the association, why do you think more realtors don't get involved? Or do you think they're not hearing the message, or they don't think there's a place for them? Do you have any insights on that?
Well, I think the blame is twofold. Number one, I don't think we've really found a way to hit our members, the ones who aren't participating, to tell them the importance of what we're doing. We send them emails. We send them, take for example, the call for action. I mean, it is so easy. What is it? One click, two click, and for those who don't know, the call for action is, if there's something legislatively going on, as the largest trade association, NAR has the ability to literally, blanket congressmen and senators' offices with a letter, on what our position is. It's one or two clicks on your internet and you're gone. I mean, the letter's gone and, you've done your job, but, we really need to find a way to make our members feel that, they really need to do it. And it's more important. Now that's on our side. When I say our, once again, organized real estate. On the other side, you know, on the member side, I think we, you know, we have that group that's not really making a living, so they don't care. And we have a large percentage of other people, you know, of other members that their attitude is, well, you know, I'm not going to do it because someone else will. And, you know, it's just, I think it's horrible, you know, not to contribute to your business. Both sides need to be overcome.
So we need to work on messaging from the leadership side, and then we need our members to understand how critical they are. And in fact, it's kind of like voting. You have people that don't go out and vote in their local elections because they think their vote's not that critical. But I'll tell you, we had three different stories in North Carolina's off-year election in 2017 that absolutely show why your vote matters. We had a mayoral race in one of our towns. The town has 92 people, okay? So we're not talking in Oakland. We're talking a tiny town called Orem, North Carolina, and there were two people running for mayor. The guy who won the seat won by two votes.
Jeez.
You know how many votes he had?
How many?
He had two votes.
Oh, come on.
We think it was him and his wife that voted for him, so he got mayor's seat because the rest of the residents didn't understand the impact that they would have just by taking 5 minutes out of their day. And I feel it's the same thing on the realtor level, which seems like it's maybe so big that individuals don't matter. But you are an example right here of you didn't like one local municipal issue. You got involved and you wind up the president of the world's largest trade association, which is no small potatoes at all.
Well, yeah, Lena, I got to tell you, I don't see any reason why everyone doesn't participate. We just did a call for action for tax reform, and we got, I believe it's 21% of our members who responded. They sent in, the letter I just talked about to their Congress people in the Senate, and 21% sounds awful low to me, but we are the envy of every other trade organization because the average response is 3%. I'm not naive to think that everyone's going to do it, but I don't see why we shouldn't hit 50 or 60%, and as I said, we've tried everything. We really just need to find a way to hit those people that aren't responding. And by the way, let me also add that we've also reached out and formed a coalition of homeowners. We have 8 million homeowners who want to be engaged in these type of issues. And it's something that came out of obviously our government affairs office in D.C. It was an idea they polled. I can't remember how many people how many households they polled, but it was a lot. And they came up with 8 million, willing to participate in the process. So I'm going to be very interested to see the numbers that come out, after this, tax mess is over.
Well, it's one thing for us as realtors to say we're the voice for our members of our communities, but then when we give them a voice, that's a really huge benefit that's being provided that I don't know most consumers would have otherwise, because they also feel very unimportant. So it's a huge message that we need to be putting out there as realtors, that we give our clients a voice through our actions, but also we give you the tools to make your voice heard. And I think this is an exciting initiative to put forth and see how it goes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, it's one of those things where, the more people that obviously do participate, the better off they are. But what's really also important with realtors is that we vote. And so that's why the letters and all that, and we have a great lobbying staff in D.C. But my last act as president was to have a fly-in of 78 realtors, federal district coordinators, FDCs, and they flew into D.C., met with congressmen and I think three senators, telling them our side of the story. And, it's funny because politicians know that realtors are, as I said, they vote, they're active in the community, and they know a lot of people. So, they're very, very conscious of that fact. And to be honest with you, Lee, I think I mentioned it briefly earlier. If this group And they're going to be congressmen and senators who we have supported. If they don't support us, we have to go after them, you know, on election time. You know,
or at least make sure that's part of the messaging, that their constituents understand exactly where they were on this issue. Because I think the implications are not going to be visible until it's too late. Just like the Obamacare issue, which I think if you're Democrat or Republican, independent, doesn't matter. That got passed and the implications are negative on just about everybody. But nobody wanted to think about that. Now you can't go back and undo it. Genie's out of the bottle. And we're trying to keep this becoming a bigger mess than it already looks like it's going to be.
I mean, that's a great analogy because, I mean, if we lose any of this stuff, we're not going to be able to get it back.
Nope. I mean, you don't undo this kind of stuff.
Right. It doesn't work like that. So it's, and you know, the other thing that, I mean, the other thing that the Republican caucus is promoting this, and yeah, but, you know, we'll make it up. We'll make up the losses in your home values because we'll have 3 to 4% growth. I mean, nobody can prove that.
No,
I mean,
it's all speculation.
Economic theory is, the whole thing is insane. But also what I'd like for, look, I'm for paying lower taxes because I think, it's getting a little political, but I think, you know, whatever you send to Washington, D.C., if you send a dollar, probably 50 cents is going to get wasted. But
you're very generous.
I'm trying to be. I'm not supposed to be real political on when I'm representing the association. But it's the type of thing that they're eliminating. You know, because this is the whole budget process is a balancing act. And if you give someone a break, you have to take a tax break away from someone else. So what we're basically doing is by eliminating. You know, the dollars saved by eliminating the mortgage interest reduction and the ability to write off state and local taxes, we are paying for corporations to get their taxes down to 20%. And also a big deal with the administration is the repatriation of dollars that are this overseas. And I mean, once again, it'd be great. I mean, if they were able to bring that money in the United States for minimum penalty. And I mean, it'd be great for the economy, but don't do it on our backs.
Right. I mean, it could be a boon, but there's no guarantee that all that money is going to magically reappear on shore just because this tax reform bill gets passed.
Very good. Very good point. And you also don't know what they're going to do with the money. If they do what they say they're going to do, you know, in terms of reinvesting in, in the form of, more office buildings, higher employment, creating new jobs, that would be fine. But, what a lot of these guys are going to do is they're going to take some of that money and start stock buybacks. So, that's not going to help anybody but them. So, I mean, I think to all of us in our business, it's a recipe for disaster.
And I want to point out one thing that you mentioned. You mentioned our federal political coordinators, our realtors who are volunteers who represent all realtors when they're speaking with their elected officials in D.C. I think it's a really important message that we give out that it's not just NAR with their staff members and speechwriters that are saying what our positions are, but when we look at situations like tax reform, there's over 1,000 pages in that act, and our lobbyists are far and away the best people on the Hill. They've read it all. They've digested it and figured out what's in it. Our realtors who go and talk to their elected officials can make sure that their senators and congressmen and women know what's in the bill, because I'm not going to fault our elected officials for not reading 1,000 pages of policy, because I've met a lot of those folks. They ain't got business reading 1,000 pages of anything. And I get it. They don't have the time for it. So we actually have people that will make them see the whole picture. So when they're voting, and they've talked to their realtors who are on the ground in their district and also educating them on these pieces, I think they have no excuse for not understanding the implications of what they're voting on, because they've been educated. And that's what we do as realtors. We educate people. I mean, we educate buyers and sellers of property, but we're also educating our elected officials. And that's part of why, if you're listening to this and you're a realtor in a small market somewhere, you got to understand that's 1,000 pages of tax code. If you're relying on the media to give the message to you, that's not correct. But our amazing professional staff members read it all and they digested it, and they're putting the message out there because we're educators. So this goes back to what you were saying about we're not going to forget who voted for and who voted against this bill, because we want to make sure it's a very clear and concise bipartisan, nonpartisan message that we're looking at, because we're not looking at R&D. We're looking at the benefit on the balance. How does it affect property owners in the U.S.?
Lee, I don't know why I'm not interviewing you.
Have a story to tell. Now that we've been on our soapbox about politics, I'm going to segue you over.
Let me tell you one other thing.
Okay.
You say one thing,
and then I'll segue.
Okay, what you just said is very appropriate. I'll never forget. I was sitting in a congressman's office, 3 or 4 years ago, and we were having a discussion. Excuse me, and knock on the door. His aide comes in and says, you have a vote in, 10 minutes. So the congressman says, okay, walk over with us, as far as you can get to the Congress. We'll continue talking. So we walk. He's literally up to the door. He said, what are we voting on? And his aide tells him, and then he goes, how am I voting? His aide says, yeah, you're voting. Yes. I mean, your point is so well taken. They don't read this. Their aides do. Their aides mm-hmm. help form an opinion, and it's critical for you have to remember that we mentioned our great lobbying staff, and by the way, our chief lobbyist Jerry Giovanello won Lobbyist of the Year this year, and as far as I'm concerned, he should win it every year. But remember, they see the same lobbyist once a week on the Hill mm-hmm. during their tenure in office, and it's when they get the faces, the realtor faces in their office from their district. I mean, it has a very big impact.
Amen and amen. Okay, so now we're going to segue to something that I think the world needs to know about you, because we talked about how one vote makes a difference. So one person can change a community, a volunteer life. One person can change the outcome of a local election. One person can also mean the difference in your personal medical health, because a one person had the right box on their driver's license. You're having this interview with me today. So tell the rest of the world that's never met you exactly what happened to you this year that was, let's just call it life-changing, because frankly, there's nothing else you could say about it.
Life-threatening, life-changing. It was, I think, at least I have always gone through life. And none of this stuff is ever going to happen to me. You see other people who are sick and you have empathy, but you never think that's going to be you in that wheelchair and that hospital bed. And, I had an operation about, on a finger, 2 years ago and 2 or 3 years ago. And I was, I had an infection in the finger, and they gave me, a drug called vancomycin to take home. And I gave myself, 2 treatments every day, liquid, the drip and all that. And after 3 or 4 days, I felt horrible and actually almost passed out. So I called him up and said, guys, I'm off of this. Give me something else that, in a pill form that's not as, not as toxic. So, as it turns out, now looking backwards, I had, a physician said that was a trigger for development of lung problems. I started coughing a little bit when I was doing some cardio, and then it got worse and worse and worse. And by I think it was June of last year, I was on oxygen, supplemental oxygen. So I was in and out of the emergency room 2 or 3 times, and I'm trying to capitalize this, of course. And on August 18th, I woke up and, things were just different. I mean, everything was just, everything around me, every place I looked, it was turning white. And, I felt like I was going to die. And, it's true. So I dialed 911, and as a side note, my wife wasn't home because we were supposed to take an international trip to Thailand and Singapore. And as she was leaving, she didn't want to go. I said, Heather, why don't you, take advantage of this, represent me, help represent NAR with other leadership that's over there. And, because what could possibly happen? So she left on the 17th. I had this incident on the 18th went to our local hospital, John Muir, and then they called up University of California at San Francisco, and UCSF said, you know, we're going to get a ambulance to bring him over here because of the problems. I was already on the lung transplant list. So I got there on the 18th, and on the 19th, I'd been on the lung transplant list for, I think, 3 weeks. 19th, doctor walks into the my hospital room and says, Bill, we found a lung for you. We're doing surgery tomorrow. I mean, it's unbelievable to it's truly a blessing to have that kind of a response in terms of having a lung available, because, you know, people wait for, you know, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, a year for a lung. And, you know, this meant my blood type and all that. And we had a successful surgery. I think it was 12 hours, 12, 14 hours. You know, Heather immediately flew back, and, you know, she was there when the surgery was going on. So, you know, it was, I was very fortunate, A, to get the donor lung, and, B, to have a successful surgery. So what I didn't know is that the donor had a MRSA infection in his lungs and pneumonia. So, but the way these guys think is unbelievable. So that's no problem. We'll just transplant the lungs and we'll treat Bill for MRSA and pneumonia. So that's what they did. So, I think it took 10, 12 days to be clear of the MRSA. But, you know, when you wake up from a lung transplant, you have, two tubes that have been put in your chest to help the chest cavity drain, you know, two on each side. And, I have all this other stuff. And, you know, they slowly start taking the tubes out as there's less and less drainage. And, they took the last tube out and they put in a feeding tube into my stomach, because they didn't want me to have to eat anything, because one of the worst things for lung transplant, one of the biggest threats, I should say, is aspiration into the new lungs. So they wanted to, you know, feed me through my abdomen. So they put that in, and you know, I got a little sick off of the feeding fluid, and the doctor said, "Well, we got to pull this thing out. We'll just put one. You know, we'll put a tube down your nose and do it that way." I tried to get him. I said, "That's crazy." I said, "You have to understand that this isn't, you know, my vast medical knowledge, right? But, you know, your own body." I'm trying to tell him that, look, I mean, this is coming from this stuff you're giving me to drink. It's not my stomach. So they pulled the tube out, and, you know, they stitched me up and sent me back to my room. And, all of a sudden, you know, my stomach started feeling, you know, like full, and then it started, you know, to extend, and then it started hurting. And, you know, I called the doctor. I said, "Hey, you guys got to give me something for pain." I said, "Yeah, but first we want to get you down for a x-ray. So, you know, they did the x-ray and said, you know, fluid is leaking into your stomach from a leak when they pulled out the tube. And so, they said, we're taking it into surgery right now." So, I mean, it's quite soberingly when, you know, down in the surgical area, they have patients waiting to have surgery. And the surgeon looked at me and said, "Don't worry, you're next." So within, you know, it was an emergency situation. And within about, I think from diagnosis to surgery was 20 minutes to a half hour, I think. So, I now have a beautiful, you know, scar from my, you know, sternum all the way down to my abdomen. But, you know, they got the problem fixed, but that really extended the stay. I mean, a typical lung transplant patient is in the hospital for 2 to 3 weeks. And then, you know, you have to go to a hotel if you don't live in San Francisco, because UCSF wants you near them in case you have a problem. But, you know, that next 6 weeks post-release, you're at UCSF 3 times a week. You're there for, you know, a couple of blood draws, and you're also there for, you know, for a clinical visit, you know, which is great. I mean, it's very thorough. Probably takes an hour and a half. You know, you talk to your doctor, a nurse, a dietitian. You know, if you need it, there's a social worker there. I mean, they have all bases covered. And, so you know, back to that 2 to 3 week stay, I was in the hospital because of the complication from the stomach, from the stomach issue. I was there for 7 weeks and went from there to a hotel in San Francisco for 6. So I just got home this past Saturday. I can't tell you how good it is to be home. I mean, you know, I haven't been home since August 18th. So it's, you know, it's good to be here with my wife, my dog. It's just, you know, familiarity. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. I don't think your listeners need the, you know, more of the gory details, but it was a very trying time. And the other thing is, I mean, it, you know, when you, especially with the MRSA and the pneumonia, the routine is exhausting. I mean, you'll have, someone come in and do an x-ray at between 6 and 7 a.m. Then you'll have, a breathing treatment. Then you'll have, you know, the doctor's on rounds, and there's this, they have this procedure called a bronchoscopy that, unfortunately they were doing, you know, they basically put a tube, down your throat into your lungs, and they try and, you know, take out as much of the excretions as they can. And I think I was having that 4 out of 5 days for a while. And it's absolutely horrible, as you can imagine, but it got me well. So, you know, you really have to balance all that out. We met another transplant patient, a woman who's a little older than I am. And she actually told the doctor after a week in the hospital, she said, you know what? She said, I'm done. She said, will you please just release me, send me to hospice and give me drugs to, make it easy. And the physician, it took a while, she said, but the physician talked her out of it. She said, please don't do this. You know, you've already gone through 1 week, mm-hmm. 2 weeks to go. It's going to get better every week and you'll be fine. And, you know, she fortunately made the decision to hang with it. And, you know, she's doing well now. But I mean, that's how intense it is. And when you're in the hospital, it's impossible to get any rest. I mean, you have, you go through this routine and you usually have it pretty easy in the afternoon. You might have a couple of breathing treatments, but, you know, a nurse will come in at, 2 a.m. to check up on you. Then, you know, either 4 or 6 a.m. to check up on you. So, you know, it's, you know, but, you know, it's funny because the nurses will tell you, you know, Bill, do whatever you can to get out of here as fast as you can. That's really when you're going to get better. You know, so, it was, should I say an interesting experience to say the least, but, you know, it was, you know, something I've obviously never been through because, you know, it was life threatening, but I'm just so lucky to get these lungs. And Lee, the good news is, I do not know who the donor is, but, you know, hopefully I will because, you know, in a month or two, I'm going to write the, donor family a letter thanking them for the lungs, but, they're supposed to be very young lungs. I mean, they make it sound like, he was, you know, between 25 and 35. But I mean, the good news is I haven't been able to breathe like this. I mean, really feel what it takes to, you know, make a real deep breath for a year and a half, 2 years, and I could do it now. So my lung surgery was successful. All I have to do now is regain some strength, regain a lot of strength, and gain some weight. So, you know, we're working on it. We're definitely working on it.
You guessed one of my questions. I was going to ask if you'd met the donor family. And I don't know if you know, there was a REMAX broker in Fort Myers, Florida named Kenzie Lee. And Kenzie had a kidney and pancreas transplant right like the week after yours. And then she got evacuated from her rehab hospital because of Hurricane Irma. So take all that transplant drama and then get shifted out of town because of Irma. But her hashtag that she's been using as she's been really evangelizing her story, which I know you're probably going to do as you know, start to have some energy back, but her hashtag is Don't Bury Good Organs. And she had the opportunity to meet the family who was grieving the loss of their loved one, but here she is keeping their kidney and pancreas alive. And I hope that you have the opportunity to find out whose lungs you have, because what a gift it is for their loved one. You don't get the loved one back, but it's a gift to know that another family is not also grieving when the lungs are what's got you alive and got Heather a husband, and now your dog can waller on top of you just like things are normal.
I have to fight for a bed space every night, but I don't care. Athena, this is a dog's world here. But, you bring up a very good point. I'm talking to some people at NAR about doing an outreach with the realtors for realtors to be organ donors. And, hopefully, you'll see something in May at our mid-year meetings. But because
make people do voter registration when they buy houses, we may as well ask them to bid on the organ donor list as well. It's not a great strain to put your name on the list.
No, it really isn't. And it could help so many people. I mean, UCSF, but once again, I'm fortunate where I live because they are minimally, they're the number one in the nation for lung transplants. And the other places that do transplants, they don't have enough organs. So, that's why, the reason I was lucky is because, my blood type is, even though it's common, you'd think it would give you more of a chance to, find a donor, but because it's common, there'll be more, recipients, on the list. But I just happened to hit it when they didn't have any, blood type A recipients on their list. I got the first lung, I should say, that came in. So I was very lucky. Being a donor, it really, unless there's a religious belief that would prohibit it, it's really easy. And obviously, it's going to really help benefit and give the gift of life to the recipient. So hopefully we'll be able to roll out something with our association and it'll be announced in May.
So you call it lucky. I'll say that was divine intervention because obviously the Lord had a plan for you to still be here. So we're not going to call it luck. That's all your California talk. The normal people of the world would say that was the Lord's blessing on you and Heather. So is there anything else you think the world should know about anything before I let you off this special edition of the podcast?
Well, yeah, and I want to go back and reflect on what you just said. Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree. It's divine intervention. I'm not discounting that at all. And I'm not afraid.
I know you're so much more politically correct than I am, but the world doesn't know you're like a half a step more politically correct than I am, but not much.
Well, you gave me the instructions on words I could not say.
And you behaved very well, thank you.
we had no slip ups. So I'm just so blessed and we always have holidays and it's, eating, drinking, giving presents and all that. This is probably the first Thanksgiving in my life where, I have the ultimate to be thankful for. And, I'll be enjoying every minute of it. If I can't drink, no alcohol for 6 months out. So, February 20th, will be my first beer. But I'll enjoy this Thanksgiving better than I've ever enjoyed a Thanksgiving before.
Well, on behalf of all the East Coast Browns, in honor of all the West Coast Browns, our Thanksgiving is going to make sure everybody is an organ donor because, we started with all of us Browns. We can fix the rest of the world, too, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a done deal, right?
That's right. Bill, I appreciate you so much, not just for your leadership in our organization, but for leading from a hospital bed and for knowing that your journey was more important than any volunteer role. And I know that we have a lot of volunteers who put themselves at risk because they don't want to miss a moment of a meeting. But I'm grateful that you knew to put your health first, because that's a message our realtors need to hear, that it's okay to miss a meeting and miss a moment if you're at the place you're supposed to be at, because you were where you needed to be. So was Heather. And so has your brother, Kevin, been right there with you the whole way. Kevin's family.
Yeah. I mean, two things. Let me end with two things. I mean, number one, and this is one thing I forgot to mention. When you go to the hotel in San Francisco, when you're released from the hospital, you have to have two or three caregivers. Heather, my brother, Kevin, and Kevin's wife, who fortunately is a registered nurse. I mean, she hasn't practiced.
Oh, that's handy.
She hasn't practiced since, she had kids. She's had kids, but she's always kept her license available. They were caregivers, and when I say caregiver, one of those three had to be with me 24 hours a day. And, you know, it's something that UCF absolutely demands. So, I mean, you know, much thanks, you know, goes out to them for their assistance, because, you know, that can't be a lot of fun. but, you know, I never heard anyone complain. And they were also just, I mean, they were so generous with their time and, you know, with the medications you have to take and all that. So, I mean, you know, I shouldn't let the conversation go on without thanking them.
It's a good reminder to all of us that you need to, first of all, go to the driver's license DMV and make sure you fix that organ donation checkbox so that you are an organ donor, but also take care of your relationships, because real estate is never the end of the world, but you need your best people around you, whether it's a brother. If you don't have a brother, you got a best friend, you got somebody you love. If you don't have a spouse, you've got somebody you love, but you got to take care of your relationships, because people love taking care of each other when we allow that to happen. So realtors, get your lives in priority order. You got to listen to President Bill, because he's telling you what's important. And then we also need you to understand that you absolutely matter. So I hope that you take away from this moment with your 2017 president that family matters. Your personal health matters. Your ability to retire matters. But most importantly, you matter. So if you're listening to this and you're not involved, shoot me a message at Lee Brown on Twitter or any of the social networks. I'll tell you who to call in your area, because I got contacts. I will hook you up, and then we will find out what's important to you, because if it's important to you, it's probably important to other realtors too. President Bill, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for all you've done for all of us, but I'm mostly just glad you're out of the hospital, out of your feeding tubes, and able to have Thanksgiving at home with people that love you most.
Absolutely. This was a lot of fun. Thanks for what you do. I mean, and I think your listeners should know that Lee's a very big contributor to organized real estate. And, you know, I'm sure she's had a lot of, you know, big things happen to her. And I know there's more big and good things for you in the future. So, you know, thanks for your service.
Oh, it's an honor to serve. We serve where we've got a gift. And like my grandma said, you bloom where you're planted. This is where I'm planted. That's where I'm going to bloom.
Very good. Very good.
And if anybody else is listening, if you want to be featured on a future episode, shoot me a note. I'd love to feature you. If you're a broker, investor, inspector, lender, or just a normal person who's had your own story about something crazy related to real estate, you could also be featured. Subscribe for more episodes. And until then, happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you next time.
For joining us this week on the Crazy Shit in Real Estate podcast. If you liked what you heard, please visit crazyshitinrealestate.com, where you can access the full show notes for this episode, additional content produced exclusively for listeners, and much, much more.